This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Congenital, Alterable, Transmissible Asymmetry, subtitled The Spiritual Meaning of Disease in Science. I believe I pronounced that right. And joining me from the New York area is the daughter of the author, Judith Haskins, the author, Morris Hyman, M.D. Thank you for joining me today, Judith.
Thank you very much, Jay. And I'm one of two daughters. I'm the younger daughter.
You're the younger one.
Slightly younger daughter.
Slightly younger. Okay. Well, we'll forgive you for being younger. You are speaking on behalf of your father. Share a little of his background story and why he's not able to join us today.
Okay. Well, first of all, the book was written in 1970, and it was written after he practiced medicine on the Upper West Side of Manhattan for three decades and spent 3.5 years in World War II as a physician. He was sent overseas at the age of 33. He spent time in Casablanca, England, France, and at the end of the war, he was in charge of a hospital in Germany with several other American doctors. And it's based on his observations beginning in World War II. And he never attempted to publish it, but his 101-year-old widow, soon to be 102, as well as his two daughters, have decided that this is something that would be of great help to people all around the world. This manuscript, now turned into a book, the subtitle of which is The Spiritual Meaning of Disease and Science. So it has both a highly scientific aspect and a spiritual aspect as well. Not religious, because my father did not practice any formal religion, but spiritual in that he had a very deep belief in God and in the magnificence of nature, including how God created the human body and et cetera.
The style of the book is a little bit technical in the way it's approached, at least from the initial observations, although it does deal with the spiritual meaning of disease and science. Where did, was this originally written for others in the medical profession? Was that his idea?
No, not at all, because my father was at odds with many doctors, many of his peers. He was at odds over their use of drug therapy, which he thought was extremely excessive. He was at odds with their use of hospitalizations, which he thought, for the most part, were a convenience for doctors, but a very stressful venue for patients. He was not in sync with most of his fellow doctors. In fact, after he graduated medical school, it was sometime later that he decided that most of what was taught in medical school he came to see as not really scientific. In fact, his concept is that diet plays a huge part in our health, and most doctors are not concerned remotely with health. They're concerned with illness, which my father would have characterized as a shadow, illness being the shadow and the light being health itself. And if doctors don't know how to create health or maintain health in a patient, then where do you go from there? Applying them with a lot of drugs that have multiple side effects. In fact, my father died some decades ago, and what has happened in the last few decades in the United States is phenomenal. We are one of two countries, only one of two countries, that allows the advertising of drugs, legal doctor-prescribed drugs, on television.
Interesting.
And what you have is a situation where so many people see a drug advertised on TV. They see very pretty pictures of people parading around looking great. they don't listen to the side effects, which are mentioned in a kind of sotto voce voice, so low voice.
Mm-hmm.
They just look, and they're, what is the word? They're enticed, they're seduced into, oh my God, take this pill and I'll feel better. And then they go to their doctors, and many of the doctors, I think, are, well, to say it honestly, I think they're legal drug pushers.
Right.
And my father was very much against the use of so many of these drugs as the first and not the last method to attain relief from any kind of problems. In fact, you don't get health from a pill. You get health from your lifestyle. And we have only to see, there's a book that just came out, The Blue Zones, and by Dan Buettner. He's written a number of books like that, where he talks about the people who've lived the longest all around, in different spots on Earth. And not only have they lived the longest, but they typically reach 100, disease-free, and fully capable of thinking and functioning without senility, dementia, aches and pains, etc.
And
there's only one. What's that?
I was going to ask your dad, your father. What was his view of vegetarianism? Was he inclined in that direction, or how was he?
Well, he went actually a little further than vegetarianism. He actually believed, and it's in his fourth chapter in this book, which is only 144 pages, but it is a densely written book. He actually believed that man evolved on this planet as an herbivore, mm-hmm. which we could also call a vegan. Vegetarians, to be precise in the terminology, are people who actually eat no meat, no chicken, and no fish. But vegans have no dairy products either, which would be eggs, butter, cream, that type of thing. In fact, dairy has only been around for about 9,000 to 11,000 years. And we've been around for hundreds of thousands of years. I became a vegan 5 years ago. I was a vegetarian for 40 years.
Okay.
I can't speak to my father about the results that I've felt. But, yes, my father believed that we evolved on this planet as herbivores. That is our true diet. And that anything that strays from that diet shortens our life and brings all kinds of illnesses along with it. And he goes into very specifics about why he believes, why he knew that we evolved on this planet as herbivores. And that has to do with the things in our body that we manufacture and the things in our body that we don't manufacture, but that we require in enormous quantities. An example, we manufacture cholesterol in our body.
Right.
No carnivore, and we're animals. We're the human animal.
Mm-hmm.
No carnivorous animal manufactures cholesterol in its body. That's why the human animal has so many problems with cholesterol, and people are taking all these statins. Then, of course, if you turn on the TV, you see an ad that says, oh, if diet and exercise doesn't work, well, in fact, diet and exercise does work. But if that's there's no profit in that for the drug companies. So what do we require in great quantities? Vitamin C, an absolutely crucial vitamin, which is highly perishable. And vitamin C, what I mean by perishable, the minute you pick a fruit or a vegetable, the nutritional content dissipates.
Is it available? Is vitamin C available? I mean, there are synthetic vitamin C's or synthetic
forms.
They
do a great job of synthesizing that. In fact, in the book, my father says that even if you're a vegan or vegetarian, but you live in one of the industrialized countries, you don't live in the tropics, then you should supplement your diet with vitamin C. Now, vitamin C, there's no danger in taking large quantities. Linus Pauling, I believe, won the Nobel Prize, or
I believe that's true.
The scientific for science, in that he advised thousands and thousands of milligrams of vitamin C. I myself take 5,000 milligrams, which would be a day, which would be the equivalent of 5 grams. The thing about vitamin C is it's water soluble, meaning any excess vitamin in your body that you don't utilize on the day that you take that vitamin passes harmlessly out of your body when you urinate. Whereas fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, and E, can become highly toxic if you're taking them in excess of what your body requires. My father didn't recommend any of those vitamins, but he did recommend both the B-complex vitamin, all the Bs, coupled with C, and both the B-complex and C are water-soluble. So I take high doses of both of those and have had no toxic reaction, because you can't. Other than your urine might be a little more yellow.
Now, share a little of the story of your mom. She is, you say, on the cusp of 102nd birthday. She has a video out on the internet that's
getting incredible response. Well, that's very interesting. I'll start with the story. She's now almost 102, but when she was 99 years old, on a very rainy day, she was at Columbus Circle in New York City, heading to my sister's apartment building where they have a pool downstairs. She was about to go swimming. Mm-hmm. She was completely independent. She was traveling by herself, and a young man in a baseball cap and carrying a camera came over and introduced himself. He said, "My name is Brandon Stanton." That's now a famous name, but this was in February of 2013, and he said, "I'd like to take your picture," because my mother was under a very colorful umbrella. He said, "I'd like to take your picture and ask you," I think his question was, "do you have something inspiring you'd like to tell people?" And at which point she said, "When my husband was dying, I said, 'Mo,'" and that's short for Morris, his name, "'Mo, what will I do without you?'"
Mm-hmm.
And my father said, quote, "Take the love you have for me and spread it around." And Brandon, each day, was photographing people and asking questions, and every day he would go back to his blog. And I believe if you look up Humans of New York, the blog, you will see he was taking pictures only in New York City. You will see that at that time he was getting a couple of hundred responses. People went really kind of crazy after they read what my mother said, and he got 81,000 followers.
Amazing.
From that comment alone. Well, we didn't know anything about this. And that happened in February. The following June, a friend of my mother's called and said, "You know, I was on American Airlines, and I saw the American Way magazine, and I opened it, and there's a picture of your mother quoting your dying father." And we said, "What?" We had no idea. Then other people started contacting us. "Oh, this guy was on MSNBC, and he showed your mother's picture and quoted your father." And apparently Brandon, he was on MSNBC, Person of the Week, and he has this book now called Humans of New York. And we heard him on TV after a lot of friends started saying, "Your mother's on TV, what is this all about?" And he was on the Ali Wentworth show too. Anyway, we contacted him by email, and we said, "This woman," that he didn't know my mother's name or anything like that, he just took her picture and took the quote. We said, "This woman that you're describing as an 80-year-old is actually our 99-year-old mother, and we'd like to invite you over to our house for some vegan cupcakes," because both my mother, my sister, and I are vegan. And sure enough, he came over. He took some photographs, which are on his website. He took those the following January of 2014, and then he said, "I'd like to make a video of your mother." And he came over the following month, and the video became available in April, and it went on YouTube. And my mother is now famous. She was 100 years old.
100 years
when he made
old.
The video.
Wow! And the title of that film on YouTube, if they look it up, is Shirley and Mo, correct?
Exactly. I believe it's M-O-E. Yes, they can go on YouTube, Shirley and Mo, M-O-E, or they can go on Brandon's website. Anyway, Brandon wound up on the bestseller list with a book of photographs and quotes from people But we were so proud of the fact that of the 10,000 people he photographed and 5,000 people that he had quotes from, he selected my mother quoting my father. And at that time, we were already in the process of figuring out how to get my father's book out there. But this became something very, kind of a very nice surprise on top of everything else.
Wonderful. Now, the book by your father, is this written or shared for a specific reason other than to honor his memory? Or are you actually thinking there's some wonderful tips and suggestions inside the book that's
That's the thing. We honor his memory by just loving him. Mm. And he was the most wonderful presence in my life until I was in my mid-20s and he died. And he was just a fabulous father, a fabulous human being, a wonderful doctor. But this is really not about our family or in any way trying to remember him, because he's impossible to forget. It's really because the things that he wrote in this book, we are convinced, could have a huge impact on people's health, their lives, their well-being, and in fact, on global warming. And that might sound kind of odd, but in fact, the meat eating industry is the number one worst industry in terms of, other than maybe the coal industry, creating global warming, the methane gas from billions of cows, and other farm animals, the water use, the land use, the pollution, all of that has a huge impact on global warming, and most people don't realize that. So the greenest way to live is not to maybe have solar panels, which is great, or a wind farm, which is superb, or recycling, which is great. But the number one thing everyone can do is become a vegan, because not only is it great for your health and great for the animals who we feel very strongly are brutalized and enslaved, very strong word, but it's great for the planet. And it's funny because when my father wrote this book in 1970, he felt it was almost a mission that he write this book. He never asked us to publish it after posthumously. He never talked about it after he wrote it, because I think he realized that in 1970 the book was way ahead of its time. But in the book he mentions that perhaps some rare environmental situation in the world would make it necessary for people to suddenly realize what kind of animals we really are. We're really herbivores and not carnivores, and there's so much proof of that. In the 45 years that I've been either a vegetarian or a vegan, I've been asked thousands of times, well, where do you get your protein? But what do they think protein gives you that you need? It gives you strength, energy, something like that?
Correct.
You think that's what
strength.
They mean?
Correct.
Well, in fact, it actually doesn't so much. Hmm. But I was just reading in the Times sports section the other day about this Katie, I believe her name is Ledecky, who is swimming competitively for the Olympics, to come the upcoming Olympics, and she's in the Olympic trials, and she did something phenomenal several days ago when she swam both the 1500 meters and then within the hour another 200 meters, both at phenomenal speeds and all of that. And they talk about what she ate before she did this swimming, because this was an unbelievable feat, even greater than what Michael Phelps did when he won his medals, because of combining these two races together, one right after the other, like 20 minutes later. Mm-hmm. So how did she fuel up? This is what she ate: a big bowl of pasta with pesto sauce.
Interesting.
A mound of rice, bread, and string beans. Where was the meat in all of that? Where was the cheese? Where are the eggs? Well, all you have to do is know something about marathon runners. Not only don't they eat meat before they run a race, that would be the worst thing they could possibly do. Greta Weitz, who was a winner of the marathon, a female runner years ago. She's no longer alive. In her obituary, it mentioned, she died several years ago, it mentioned that the first race she ever ran, she had something like shrimp cocktail before she ran the race. She felt like she was going to die before she got to the end. Now, doesn't that make people want to think, well, wait a minute, if this is our diet, then why is it that when we have to achieve great feats of physical prowess, we stay away from these things?
Interesting. Well, you've got.
Do you find that interesting?
Absolutely. You've raised some very fascinating questions, and the book also addresses this. Judith, your dad was a little bit unusual as a doctor in his physician fees. Share with my listeners how he conducted himself there.
Well, let me just say the book is both tending to people's physical as well as their spiritual well-being. And my father, I would say, was the richest man I ever met, not rich in money, but rich in spiritual qualities, in the desire to inspire other people. He practiced medicine on the Upper West Side for 30 years, never raising his fees above $5 a visit.
Incredible.
He had patients that were millionaires, and he had patients that had very little money, and they all were charged $5 a visit. He made house calls at 2 and 3 in the morning, driving his VW Bug, which got broken into numerous times because of the MD license plates. He had to have the MD license plates removed from his car because at that time there was a drug epidemic and people had broken into his car a number of times to steal his prescription pad and all that. So he kind of risked his life for $10 for the house call to go and see someone maybe at 2 and 3 in the morning. But if you never paid him, he still continued to see him, to see you. And I'll just give you a very quick story about that. When I was a teenager, I was typing up his bills one time, $5 here, $5 here, $10 here, and all of a sudden I see a bill, and the name of the person was J. Poole III. I'll never forget that. And the bill was for something like $265. I said, whoa, look at this. And I went and I showed my mother. Then we went to my father, and I said, what is this bill all about? And he said, that's a cumulative bill. Mm-hmm. In other words, Mr. Poole never paid my father, and it didn't matter. My father continued to see him, not because my father was some kind of sucker. It was because my father didn't want to get rich on the backs of other people suffering. He wanted to help people both physically and spiritually, which is what I deeply hope, as well as what my mother and sister hope, will happen if people read his book.
Incredible. He had a wonderful legacy. And listeners, you can locate the book, maybe not by title, but you can certainly locate it by the name of the author, Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, last name H-Y-M-A-N, M-D. The title, again, is Congenital Alterable Transmissible Asymmetry. I think I said that correctly. The Spiritual spiritual Meaning of Disease and Science, written by our guest's father, Morris Hyman, M.D. Judith Haskins has been my guest. Judith, where can we get a copy of your book?
Well, Archway Publishing has a website, and dare I mention their competitor?
Go ahead.
Can I mention Amazon? Mm-hmm. Amazon, and it, also Barnes & Noble. And if you go on any of these websites, you can read a chapter, a sample chapter. We also have a blog and a Facebook page and something which I haven't been contributing to because I don't know too much about social media, but there are a number of quotes from the book. I did want to very quickly say that the four words, that congenital alterable transmissible asymmetry, was my father's description of what a disease is. And the fact is doctors don't make a distinction between diseases and viruses and bacterial conditions.
That's true.
And this isn't a semantic thing. Diseases, the number one quality of a disease like heart disease, lung disease, cancer, is the inherited quality. That's the congenital quality.
Correct.
Whereas Ebola virus is a virus, and you don't inherit it from your parents. Diseases, true diseases, are not infectious. You can be in a room with 1,000 cancer patients or people suffering from heart disease or lung disease, and you won't get it.
Mm.
But if you're in the room with even someone who died of Ebola virus, you will get it. So the fact that we've made great strides in combating viruses, But, of course, with vaccines that bring on other problems, and my father in 1970 saw that the constant use of vaccinations, though good, could increase the number of viruses, and shortly after he died, the AIDS virus, which is not a disease, it's a virus, came about. So that's his description, and he goes through that very carefully. He goes through heart disease and what causes cancer is in the book. So we think it could be of great help to other people, and that it would be very selfish of us not to put the book out there.
Well, thank you, Judith. Thank you, Judith, for sharing that information and the background story of this book.
Thank you for giving me the time to do it.
This is a great, great book for anyone who is concerned about their health and wants to get an alternative view that may increase not only the years but the joy of living that they will experience.
Exactly.
Thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Congratulations on being the proud owner of an adorable, soft, cuddly, sweet-smelling, smiling, cooing, hungry, tired, gassy, screaming little bundle of joy. So now what? Where's the owner's manual for this thing? Where are my instructions? Right here. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Infant care specialist Blythe Lipman has worked with babies for over 20 years and works extensively with new parents, providing workshops, in-home visits, tips, and daily phone calls to ease those frazzled nerves. With Baby and Toddler Instructions, you can get the advice you need on how to survive and enjoy your baby's first year. For more information on Blythe and how she can help you, go to babyinstructions.com. From 32 ways to stop a baby from crying to 14 ways to get a baby to eat and so much more. It's Baby and Toddler Instructions with Blythe Lipman on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Finding Zen in San Francisco Transit, a bus driver's perspective. And joining me on the phone from San Francisco is driver Douglas Merriweather. Sir, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jay. Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to talk about the book.
This is interesting. You have a career that's spanned 16 years as a transit driver, and I'm sure I've seen lots of interesting things during your watch. You decided at some point 188 pages was something you had stories to tell. What motivated you to put this into print?
My passengers on my bus, we'd start a conversation, and they say, hey, you know, you should write about this. And that went on for, you know, like I say, almost 16 years. And I thought, hey, you know what? As far as I know, there's really been no book written from the bus driver's perspective.
I think you're probably right. I've not known of any. The only the most famous bus driver, I think, was Ralph Cramden on the Honeymooners, which was an old time television show. He certainly elevated that position in an interesting way. In your book, is it a book of stories? Is it just your personal perspective on life? How would you describe it?
Yeah, it's mainly an essay. It's like about 57 chapters of vignettes or essays or anecdotal information about my life as a bus driver on a daily basis and what goes on inside the head of a bus driver, because many people in San Francisco while waiting for the bus wonder what goes on inside our head. And so we've heard from the politicians, we've heard from City Hall, we've heard from the riding public, but have we ever heard from the bus driver?
Right. 16 years was or is your perspective on being a transit driver one that you really have enjoyed the journey so far and the trip?
Yeah, the first 5 years were really tough. The first 2 years were just, I had to really dig my claws in, or I just had to just hold on tight, and I knew that if I could just keep the job and stay at the job, that eventually it would become easier, would become a working part of the mind, and that it wouldn't be stressful. And so I can say to you today that right now my shift, my run, I can go for weeks on end without any altercations or problems.
That's phenomenal. You've titled it Finding Zen. Explain for my listeners what a Zen is and how you got it.
Yes, Zen is like a way of being or a state of mind that is relaxed, that just like with this interview, Jay, that we can talk and have emotional availability with each other. And Zen, of course, it brings images of like going to Tibet and sitting in the lotus position.
Right.
But basically, it's just the state of mind that we have when we interact with others, you know, or driving a 10-ton vehicle down the street in a dense, compact city.
In your book of 188 pages, which of the stories did you find the most entertaining to tell and recount?
Well, I do have the clip on the Audible version of The Late Ring as a very good chapter that summarizes a lot about the answer to your last question about how do you find Zen
right
on the bus. But my favorite chapter really is Morning Rush, talking about when we go out the door to catch the bus. I had a run that just missed the last express. And so people would come out of their house in the avenues of 22 and 23 to get downtown, and they were late. And so I had a run that had to be downtown just after 9 a.m. when people had to clock in, and it was very stressful.
Wow. Your stories are not lengthy as individuals. Your chapters are relatively brief. How long did it take you to remember these stories, or were you keeping track of those throughout your journey as a transit driver?
That's a really good question. And some of the chapters were from events such as the Run from Hell, which was Morning Rush, was based on Run 84 that I did back in 2005, and I'll never forget that run. So some of the chapters I just remembered from the painful experience of having gone through it. But then what I did was, after I had about 50 pages, then I had this, what I started doing was taking a little spiral notebook that I shirt, you know, like 99-cent pocket notebook, and I would start to write things down as they occurred in 2010, and then on the weekends I would compile into a chapter. And so I started really working on this in May of 2010.
So this has taken a couple years or more to complete everything.
And yes, and it goes from the span of my 16 years, which actually now I'm in my 17th year, since the book has been out for about a year, since December of 98 was when I started. And so, it's some of it is the tears that I shed when I was new, but then a lot of it is about how I'm handling the situation now with over 10 years under my belt.
Phenomenal. Your one chapter is titled The Noodle. What is the noodle?
Oh, yeah, the noodle was given to me by an old-timer, a senior line trainer, where one of the stresses that occurs is when the bus pulls away from the curb and from the bus stop, and motorists get on the horn, they freak out, they want to gun it around us because we're billboarding, which is a term of meaning we can't see around. And so the noodle is you don't give your turn signal. In fact, that's the cue that drives cars crazy. You continue straight, leaving the zone near side, which is that the bus stop is on the first corner of an intersection. You slowly creep forward, leaving the zone. Then, when the second or third car behind sees that the bus is moving, you can then drift back into the traffic lane because you've given those first two cars they see that you're starting to move and you're leaving the zone. And so you don't really need to even give the turn signal to merge smoothly with traffic. So the noodle is a way to merge in with traffic at an intersection without people using the horn.
I remember a song my kids used to sing, the wheels on the bus go round and round. Your story, is this a book that's going to be, embraced by only people who love transit stories, or is this something that may have a deeper meaning for you and for the listener or for the reader?
Well, you know, it really takes interest from my coworkers who didn't believe that I had a book. They, you know, no one believed that I wrote the book. I had to actually physically show them the book, you know, and they were no, really. And then when I saw it, showed them the picture on the outside of the cover, and then they were incredulous and supportive. But in answer to your question, you see, San Francisco is unique, and so we're a real urban city that has very frequent trolley service, where buses come on the 38 Geary, they come every 2 or 3 minutes, and on the 1 California, 2 or 3 minutes. No other city, I believe, has surface transportation where a bus comes, like 2 or 3 buses come within 5 minutes.
Wow.
And so this is written from a point of view that may not exist in Midwestern cities and the like. But in essence of your question, yes, I really hope that people can take the message of this when it comes to finding a parking place or other traffic scenarios in other parts of the country. But San Francisco is very unique, and so that's why I thought it would have an appeal. And, yeah, I do hope that it appeals to others, not necessarily, you know, in a large city of almost a million.
Is there any personal things or personal challenges that you overcame in life or in completing this book that you'd like to share with my listeners?
Well, as I say, one of the first chapters is, I would never do your job.
Uh-huh.
And so that also is like, people, if you were to sit shotgun, which is the seat across from the driver in the number one position on the passenger curbside of the bus, and just look at the continuous threats from skaters, cyclists, other motorists, you would almost be in awe of how could anybody do this job and how could anybody remain calm. And so it's just the challenge to keep this job and stay at the job and to make the job look easy. And it's all the job I'll ever want. I don't want to, to me, I don't really need to seek any other status or a higher job. To me, just like Ralph Cramden, Jackie Gleason and the Honeymooners, it provides enough entertainment.
Entertaining every morning. You don't know what's going to happen that day. Have you encountered any what I would call serious incidences on your bus, or have you seen any in the transit system of San Francisco that perhaps gave you a little bit of a start?
Well, fortunately, I haven't run over anybody or hit anybody, and fortunately, I haven't killed anybody. But one of my friends made contact with a coach. He stepped out between parked cars around 1 in the morning on 8th Street by Fillmore, and he's no longer with us. And there are some really visceral, sad, shocking stories of people caught in the crosswalk that changed direction after they passed the halfway mark, and the operator assumed they would continue on their way to the curb, and they didn't.
Wow.
And so we were having about one fatality every other month, and unfortunately that has not been my case. But because we've hired so many new drivers and because we're getting all new equipment on a relatively short depreciation cycle, things do look better. Things look like the tragic accidents that we've had seem to not be occurring as frequently as when I was in the middle of my years, like in the early 2000s.
And no robberies from what you've described, so that also is a positive thing.
Well, I did have the police track the tracking device in an iPhone, and we followed the tracking device on a phone, and the girl got her phone back. And so returning cell phones is an awesome thing. Even
yeah.
Returning a laptop, a computer. And so Lost and Found is one of the last chapters in the Tao of Doug 2, my next book, that is also in a continuation of this first book. So I do have a second book of Keeping Zen in San Francisco Transit, a line trainer's guide, which is mainly more for bus drivers, for the new people that we have, whereas this book is mainly for passengers.
What is the most enjoyable or fun thing about your job besides just getting there and going through the process? Have you encountered an incident that you think is going to be the most enjoyable incident that you've recounted for the reader?
Yes. Well, I have a thing where I do passenger of the day. Now, of course, we're all thinking of like operator of the month or all these big contests or lottery type mentality. But for me, passenger of the day. Now, if I award you passenger of the day, that means you're beating out like maybe 500 to 800 other people on a busy trip for the whole day. And passenger of the day is that passenger who's a regular rider, who knows where to stand, who is ready. They have it ready. They can see the fare in their hand. They come right up to the steps. It's really dramatic when they can be walking without stopping from around the curb or corner and come right to the correct place on the bus stop. I hit the door open. They come right on in. They tag in with a smile, and they sit right down, and it's like, wow.
It sounds
so
like...
I look for passenger of the day every day, and that's kind of an entertaining thing. And oh, just like Bill Murray in Caddyshack, there's no money involved.
Yeah.
But when you die, you will receive pure extreme consciousness.
There you go. The title of the book, Finding Zen in San Francisco Transit, A Bus Driver's Perspective. And my author, Douglas Merriweather, without an A, it's Merriweather. If you're looking for this book online, your local bookseller, where else can they get a copy of this, Doug?
Yeah, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and of course, check out all the really interesting self-published books on the Balboa Press website, and Audible.com, ACX, does have this version for download for if you're on the treadmill at the gym or you don't have time to actually read.
Very good, and another book is in the future, you mentioned, and how soon will that be released?
Well, I haven't gotten to the Audible version yet, but that has just come out this year, and it is it's just amazing how much information and how many stories I can tell about this job. But The Tao of Doug 2 is now available also on Amazon and at Balboa Press and Barnes & Noble.
Driver Doug and author Doug, thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. This sounds like an enjoyable read, a lot of interesting facts that many of us may not know about the transit system and your journey as well. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Do you ever wonder if you're the only woman who runs errands in her yoga pants so it will look like she went to the gym? Or how about the only mom who feeds her kids raw cookie dough? Or are you the only one who cooks her family cold cereal for dinner? Do you need more laughter and less loudness? More self-love and less self-loathing? More joy and less judgment? You're not alone. Come to the living room. A place where we get comfy, candid, and confident together. Come seeking sanctuary and leave feeling renewed. We're saving a seat for you. Give yourself some living room today.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Love on the Rocks, A Positano Tale by Katie Costa. Thank you for joining me from California today, Katie.
Thank you.
How did you get interested in Positano, and where is Positano located?
Well, Positano is in the Amalfi Coast in Italy, and I've done a lot of traveling in Italy, and I had actually never been there. And my best friend and I, we were planning a trip one summer, and she said, "Oh, you've got to go to Positano. You'll love it. It's amazing." So we went, and then continued going there the next 3 summers.
Wow!
So yeah, that's how it started.
And for my listeners, you have a background as a teacher, so the summer months would be traditionally time that you could devote to travel.
Yeah, absolutely. The height of tourist season. But that doesn't usually happen. So my best friend was also a teacher, and we would plan trips together and somehow always ended back up in Positano.
You also are an individual, as an author, this is an important skill to have or an important habit to be in. You keep notes. You have a travel diary. How do you remember some of the events that you have included in your tale?
Well, I would. I've always kept a travel journal, even when I was little on family vacations. But I would just, at the end of the day or whenever I had time or the next morning, I would just, you know, start writing down the events of the previous day. And that's how I would do it. That doesn't work for everybody, but that's what I would do. There were so many crazy things that were going on that I was like, oh, I got to write this down before I forget it.
It's a wonderful trait. I wish I had that skill. I don't have the discipline to remember what I did in the morning. Sometimes I have to look at my laundry tags to remember who I am. So you've done a great job. The Love on the Rocks, the title. How would you describe your novel?
I would say it is light romance, chick lit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's geared toward females of all ages. So it's, you know, got some romance, got a lot of food, the disco, the beach. I mean, it's really geared towards females, I would say. Not that men can't enjoy it, but I'd say it's more for women.
Katie, how long did it take to decide to write this novel, Love on the Rocks, or follow the dream of becoming an author? How long have you been on that quest?
I always enjoyed writing. I wrote stories when I was young in grammar school, just for fun, plays, things like that. And then when I decided to start writing this novel, it took me probably 3 years. And that's basically due to the fact that I teach. So my writing was kind of kept to the weekends and vacations because it was hard to kind of fit it in. So it took me about 3 years. And then I just kind of put it on the back burner and was working on other projects. And then within the last year, I decided I really wanted to do something with it. I'd had no luck sending it into editors or publishing houses. I'd gotten good feedback from editors back east, but they just weren't ready to take on new projects from unknown authors. So I decided to go the self-publishing route, and that's when I contacted Lulu. So this has all been happening within the last year.
Phenomenal. And as a first-time author, 468 pages is an ambitious project. I mentioned to you earlier.
it was a lot longer, too. I had to cut a lot out.
I talked to some authors. I did have one author, I think, that wrote 1,100 or 1,200 pages the first attempt out and had to, reduce it considerably. 468 pages is still a wonderful length for a first-time author. Was the editing anything that was complicated for you? Was it difficult to pare down some of the storyline that you had created?
Originally, one of the publishers that had actually given me feedback upon telling me no, they didn't want my work, was to cut it out. Like, you need to cut it down and get the two characters to Positano a lot faster than you have. So I cut out a considerable chunk of the original work. And that was, that was on my own doing editing. But once I was working with Lulu Publishing, the editing wasn't too bad. It was more like looking into grammatical things. The story was pretty solid, and it flowed, and there wasn't much to patch up. It was really just had to do with, making sure everything was grammatically correct and the syntax was in check and all that.
Well, that would be important as an educator and an author.
Absolutely, and the daughter of an English teacher.
Oops.
So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the storyline itself, I have authors that approach the creative side of their efforts differently. Some will sit down and just let the story take them or the storyline take them. Others will sit down and probably write an outline, basically flesh out the characters, and then develop their storyline. Which of those approaches did you use?
I had a basic framework. I knew the characters very well. They're loosely based on myself and my friends. So I have that in place. The fun part was really getting to play around with reality and what happened and what didn't happen. So I had a basic framework. I combined a lot. I took a lot from you know, past summers and then the one particular summer. So I had a basic plot that I was working with, and then I added a lot of things that obviously were not true and tweaked things and changed characters. So basically the plot was already really intact, and I worked from that.
You've called this a chick-lit novel, in other words, designed or written specifically desiring to have a female audience. Is there anything about the characters that you have included that is maybe unique or will make them stand out to the reader?
I think, and I've read a lot of novels for women lately, I think, tend to focus, and TV shows for that matter, focus on people in their 20s. And you're kind of seeing like a new surge of things geared towards women in their 30s, maybe. I think I felt that was unique. And it was also a story that's set in Positano. I've read a lot of books about Italy, but I've never come across anything, to my knowledge, I could be wrong, that's been completely set in Positano. So I think that also sets it apart.
Is it contemporary as far as time frame, or does it go back a few years?
It is. It's relatively recent, yes.
Relatively recent in the style and content. Which of the subplots do you think is going to be the most outstanding, and maybe you hope some producer might get a hold of it and decide to develop it into a movie of some type?
Wow. There are so many subplots. I'd say the two main characters have a lot going on. I mean, one is kind of in a befuddling love triangle. She's, you know, kind of running away from a horrible relationship and then is really not looking to find romance and finds herself in the middle of a love triangle. And then the other one is, you know, in love with, or thinks she's in love with, you know, this one guy that doesn't give her the time of day. Hmm. So it's, you know, that old song and dance of, you know, the one you want, you can't have.
Right.
Kind of a thing. It goes back and forth. And there's just a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of drama and confusing things that happen, but are also really funny. And some of it has to do with, you know, it's a different culture and Americans intermingling with Italians and not always understanding what's going on. So that adds kind of to the hilarity, I guess.
Is there an underlying moral that popped out maybe unintentionally from the completion of Love on the Rocks?
I think it's about, you know, everybody's got their issues and their problems. And sometimes we think running away to some type of different scenery or time zone is going to fix things. And vacations are great, but you can't always take a vacation from, you know, your real life problems. They're always going to be there. So I think that was part of it. And just like enjoying life and appreciating other cultures and appreciating also what you have is, I think, another underlying theme or moral.
I think that's a wonderful goal. In fact, I've heard that. My dad used to tell me all the time, you can move, you can go someplace else, but you can't get away from yourself.
That's true, yeah.
Katie, you mentioned that you had done some extensive editing on this novel. Is it material that you might include into a sequel as a follow-up to what you've already penned?
You know, it could. People have asked me if I wanted to do a sequel. I'd never thought about it. I guess I could, the way I ended the novel, you can go. But I guess with the stuff that I edited out, I could probably do a prequel if I wanted to. I think I ended up doing a prologue, writing the prologue, which took a little bit from what I had cut out originally to kind of set the story up. So I don't know that I would. I don't know that I'd work on a novel set before this trip, but maybe a sequel.
Sure. And any other things in the works at this point?
I am. I started a novel actually about 4 years ago while I was leaving this one on the back burner for a bit to take a break from it. So I am working on another women's novel on dating in your 30s.
Excellent. I think contemporary subject should be well received. Have you been able to get any feedback from readers that has has caused you to be kind of content with what you've accomplished so far?
I actually have. And granted, it's been local, and I'm hoping this really branches out across the country. But locally, I've gotten a lot of feedback from women actually in all different age ranges, which has been really great. Like women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, up to their 70s. They're all taking away different things from this. Either, you know, the love of travel or relating to the characters. It's been really good. It makes me feel good that it is a story that people can relate to and enjoy.
Congratulations. The title again is Love on the Rocks, A Positano Tale, author Katie Costa. Thank you for joining me today. My listeners are going to want to get a copy of your book and possibly follow you as a fan. Do you have a website, or how will they get a copy of the book?
The book is available on Lulu.com, Amazon.com, and BarnesandNoble.com right now. And we are working on the blog, so that will be set up relatively shortly, where they can follow me. They can Google my name and look that up.
Super. And Katie is spelled with a C, C-A-T-I-E. Costa,
yes,
C-O-S-T-A. And if they do a search online, they'll not only bump into you, but also your publications, and certainly, hopefully, become a fan of yours. Thank you for joining me today, Katie.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.